So welcome back to Dharma in Pajamas, a different location and a different set of pajamas each time. And the topic for today is, who am I really? Who am I really? I don't know if you've ever had that question before. If you can remember when that question first arose in your mind. So that's what we'll just have a little chat about this morning, and we can set our motivation that of a motivation of sincerity and curiosity, which is a nice colloquial way of saying to make sure we have a good heart. We're doing this for ourselves and others, and to also develop our wisdom. We can have a chat. This chat can lead all the way to enlightenment. So this question, who am I really? Many times this has arisen in my mind in different ways that I've tried to answer it. And sometimes I've gone back through my life and picked out various things and gone, oh, yeah, this is who I am. And then I've picked out a whole different set of things and I've come to a completely different conclusion. And it's left me completely confused. Who am I and how do I bring meaning to my life? So where this question ties in is to the doctrine of no self in Buddhism, or selflessness. And if you're a beginner, this is a really confusing term, because when we hear about selflessness, what we think is altruism, being not being selfish, being selfless, acting for others. But in Buddhism, it has a totally different meaning. Selflessness means it's a philosophical understanding of the mind, and it means no inherent self or no true self. Selflessness. And so once you kind of understand that, then you can also have a tendency to go right over to the other side and go, oh, Buddhism is nihilistic. There is no self at all. There's nothing. And that also is a mistake, really easy one to make. So that's why I thought I'd bring this one up at the moment, because it's things that I've been through many times. So the question, who am I really? You know, it depends. And the urge to know who we are really, and then grasping onto this answer and that answer, comes from what is called one of the afflictive emotions, which is pride, or trying to figure out who we are by comparing ourselves to others, by feeling better when we compare ourselves to others, or feeling important or special in comparison to others. And so this kind of answer of who am I, when it comes in this comparison, we may feel special in a room. We may be the special one and have some distinction that we think is you know, pretty good. But the moment we do that, we may feel better, but we put a separation between ourselves and others. So on one hand, we're feeling special, but also we're lonely, isolated, easily intimidated. So finding out who we are really by this external comparison is fraught with danger and with misery. And we end up being quite isolated. That kind of egocentricity, that really deep instinctual kind of pride or grasping at a self or identity, goes all the way back to that fundamental ignorance that we have of just not understanding who we are. So it's a good place to start this question, who am I really? And then just take a nice, relaxed, kind of gentle, kind approach to it. So when I was trying to figure out who I was really and if I was any good as a human being, it was years ago when I was also living in Brisbane and I was a costume maker and I made costumes for circuses. Really fantastic costumes. It was a huge amount of fun going to work, watching people do circus tricks, you know. and I became really good at making circus costumes, and I was the best in Brisbane. So I would put myself in that context and I go, oh, yeah, I'm the best in Brisbane. I'm fantastic and I feel really good and confident and happy. And then I think, well, you know, let's go on a bit more. What if I go to New York and I start up my costume business there for the circus? And then I start going, oh, my God, I don't know, and I'm a little fish in a big pond and I'll be worthless and useless, and I got really scared and demoralized. This all happening over my morning cup of coffee. So then I go, no, I'll stay in Brisbane. And I said, oh. So how who we are really is very contextual. Another example I'll give you is all my different hair colors. So who we are really is so much dependent on our circumstances in the context we find ourselves in. And we think that's us, but it's actually this, we're quite reactive to our circumstances, and we are inextricable from our circumstances. So when I first started dyeing my hair in the 80s, I had bright orange hair, I think. And that was like a red rag to a bull for a lot of young Australian men. And so my common experience would be to walk down the street and have things thrown at me from out of cars, like Coke cans and rubbish and stuff, and people yelling at me. So I got quite used to having this really negative response to what I looked like. And then I'd play with not taking it personally. So I'd notice that feeling of being scared and upset, and then I'd go, well, you know, does their response make me any different or not? And how much do I depend on the positive feedback of others for me to feel good, and how much comes from within me? So this is where I kind of learnt that self-expression is very much my own internal process. It's not for others necessarily. And it's certainly not dependent on others. So that was a pretty hard lesson to learn. Then later on, I thought, oh, I just want a break. So I went blonde for 1 year. And I tell you what, people treated me so nicely. They talked quietly to me. They talked slower. They smiled a lot more. And they did stuff for me without even being asked for a whole year. It was just extraordinary. And because I had not been used to it, I didn't take it personally. I didn't think that was me. I just thought, wow, this is amazing. Just the change of hair color can change how people respond to you. And how people respond to you changes how you feel about yourself. So who am I really? Anyway, then after that, I had a few different hair color changes. And then I had kind of pink hair, various shades of pink to red. And that was a little bit of a red rag to a bull for a while too, until the pop singer Pink came out, and then she normalized it, and now it's kind of acceptable and okay. And also, now that I'm becoming an old lady with pink hair is totally different from a young lady with pink hair, because young lady with pink hair is like an insult to some people. But an old lady with pink hair, I'm like the designated brave one. And so now, instead of people being intimidated, they run up to me in the street, especially little old ladies, and they say, oh, I'm so glad you've got pink hair. It's so inspiring. I wish I could, but my children would never forgive me. So all of that's changed as well. Okie dokie. So that gives you a little bit of a background. Now, let's have a look at how we actually identify who we are. So if we take away our hair color, whether we have hair or not, whether we have thick hair or thin hair, all of the different ways that we feel about ourselves, about our hair. I mean, when the nuns become ordained, they shave their hair off, so there's no such thing as a bad hair day. And that whole building of an identity, presenting a face, you become free of it. So imagine if you didn't have to have that face, that hair and makeup and whatever, if you're free of that, how you would feel different, how your life would be different. What would people relate to then? So, you know, we can take that bit away. Then what if we took away gender? So if you think about, say, you know, if you're a woman and you've lived your, if you lived your whole life, everything that happened to you in your life, but you were a guy, same things happen, same education, same family, but if you're a guy, it would have been a totally different result. In your job, you wouldn't have hit the glass ceiling. What things you were encouraged to learn as a child all would have been totally different. So gender plays a huge amount of who we are. And if you're a guy, you have the same life as you are, but you lived it as a girl. Wow, totally different. So who we think we are is actually just our gender. And that, as we know, is a fluid thing. It's a cultural thing and it can change. But we think it's us, so we just assume it's us. So let's take that away. Then we can take away age. So when you're young, full of energy, fresh-faced, you think it's you. That natural blush of youth, you think is you. And as you get older and it fades and you start being tired and not so confident, and you start realizing, oh, all of that that I thought was my just naturally me was actually just youth. And now it's fading. So who am I? Or when you feel old, and as you get older, some people get more confident and others get more demoralized because their body is aging and they're identifying with their body, their age. They're no longer, you know, young and beautiful, so what's left? So let's take away age and everything associated with that. We can also take away race. So I sometimes think, what if I had have lived my life, but I had have had dark skin? You know, so I'm in that privileged quota. Yes, I'm a woman, which makes me, you know, not such a high status, but a white woman. So there's a huge amount of natural privilege that comes along with that, that you think it can think is you. This kind of, you know, they talk about the age of entitlement. So I think, what if I was a woman and black? My life would have been so different, so much more difficult. The kind of confidence that I have of walking around, I wouldn't have. I would be fearful. I'd have to be so much stronger. I'd have to be so much bite my lip and not say and not retaliate, all of those things. All of the stereotypes that come with race that you have to live through. So what if we take that away, which is a huge thing? What if we take away marital status, you know, our role in the family? So many times we identify with that so strongly, and then, you know, like if you're a mother and you have kids and then the kids leave home, and then you have empty nester syndrome because so much of who you are was bound up with your role. Then the role changes and now who am I? The midlife crisis, when you get to, you know, that age and maybe you lose your job, you get retrenched, or your job no longer is fulfilling. It's because those roles change and we're so bound up with them. And if, like in this crisis, you've lost your job, you may have also lost your confidence and your sense of identity because it's so bound up in that. So let's take all of that away as well. Our marital status, our occupation, our education, whether we can read or not, whether we're educated or not, whether we can say we have this degree or that degree or not. A lot of that kind of status is bound up there too. Take away what we own. That also has a huge effect on us that we may not realize. But if you've been brought up quite well off, there is a natural confidence that comes from having a safety net to know that whatever happens, there's going to be people you can borrow money off, or that you can borrow the car, or that can drive you somewhere. And that kind of confidence you think is you. That's that age of kind of entitlement. If you've grown up poor and you don't have enough, and that constant gnawing anxiety about how am I going to make rent, how am I going to feed everybody, what happens if I have to put new tires on the car or buy new shoes or get a winter coat, and that incredible shyness that comes from poverty, that also becomes you, and you become demoralized. You think that's you, and it can grind you down. So if we take away that, what we own or what we don't own, take away language and culture, how we identify with our ancestors and our genealogy or whatever is it all the way back. You know, like when we're, if you're an Italian immigrant, you know, you come to Australia and everyone thinks you're a foreigner. You go back to Italy and everyone thinks you've got an Aussie accent. So who am I? You'd find that too, wouldn't you, Lisa? With, you know, in America, you're Australian. In Australia, you're American. And it's so much just to do with the accent. And doesn't that change how people respond to you and who they think you are? So let's take that away. So what's left? take away gender, age, hairdos, colour of your skin, language, culture, race, education, occupation, family. What's left? So it's a really good question to keep asking. Who am I? Am I all those circumstantial things that change over time? We can't really be those. So who am I really? And so many times you'll find the answer that comes up is what we do or what's happening to us. But who are we really? So what's left actually isn't what distinguishes us from others, what makes us different from others, which are all these circumstantial things. What you find, isn't it? What's left is I'm a living being. I'm a human. But even more than that, you take away whether we're a human or a cat, I'm a living being. I'm a being who thinks and feels and experiences. That's who we are really. And that's who everybody is. So that's this huge, very deep, fundamental commonality that we have with everybody. So that draws us closer together and also makes us feel better because it's very realistic, but it draws connection and it's in step with reality. It recognizes we have this in common. We're equal in wanting to be happy and not wanting suffering. And everything else is circumstantial and changeable. And yet, what do we grasp on for who am I? Who am I really? So I was thinking about there was this incredible rally in the 60s with the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And it was a civil rights rally. And he gave this famous speech where he got everybody, this huge crowd like in a football stadium, to say, I am somebody. It was so moving. And this was a real unifier because all of these people have been completely disenfranchised and pushed down and everything. Wasn't distinguishing themselves apart from someone else like pride. It was really finding a commonality. And because you are alive, because you have feelings, you matter. And just by saying that, I am somebody. So powerful. Really, really unique. And that was really coming to this, of this commonality and of recognizing that it matters. So from the Buddhist point of view, who we are, the things that we can really take pride in and hold on to that are realistic, based in reality, are that we have incredible potential as a human being. That's one thing. As a human being, we matter, we have feelings, and we have this potential that can go all the way to freedom, enlightenment, liberation and enlightenment. That's our natural potential. We can do it. We don't need anything else to change. We can do it. It's not dependent on gender and age and wealth and status and all of those things. It's dependent on the fact that we're a living being and that we have these fortunate circumstances as a human. Also, as a human, we have so many more choices that we can make than, say, an animal. You know, an animal can't choose whether they want to be vegetarian or not. It's just how they're physiologically built. A lion can't go, I'm going to go vegan. They'd die. But human beings, we have a much more leeway to make choices. So this is something that that we can recognize within ourselves. Yes, it's kind of circumstantial from a Buddhist point of view because we have a perfect human life now and we may not in the future and we did it in the past. So that's kind of a unique set of circumstances. But when you recognize how important and precious and how much potential there is in our own life, then we also recognize it in other people's lives. And that's what we focus on. We don't focus on the differences. We don't get scared of them. We don't hate them. We just have this natural recognition. We can also, who am I really? We can look at our actions and Lama Zopa Rinpoche often talks about being an inner professional. So we have an idea about professionalism, don't we? And from a Buddhist point of view, this is like being proud of our virtues, our virtuous actions, our actions that benefit others. So if you're a first responder or a school teacher or work in childcare or anything like that, society expects a certain amount of professionalism, don't they? That you will treat everybody in the class equally, with equal care and concern, regardless of whether you get on with them or not, regardless whether you like them or not, regardless of whether you even understand them, you've got this kind of duty of professional care. And we just naturally expect that of people. But that's a big ask, isn't it? Because that means inside we have to be able to do that. We have to recognize that other people are as important as we are, even if we don't agree with them. So that's something that we can look at as, this is who I am. I am a virtuous person. And it's important that we focus on that, not on our negativities. So another story from the civil rights movement, when there was, I think it was some form of, there was a lynching and a bit of a riot. Again, it was in the 60s. And one of the Ku Klux Klan guys, you know, in his white hat with the eyes and everything, was injured and taken in an ambulance to the hospital. And when he got to the hospital, to the emergency department, everybody in the, all the nurses in the emergency department were black. And so their professional code of conduct was to look beyond that white sheet, beyond the white skin, to the blood and bones underneath, just like we all have. Now that to me is incredible. That's an inner professional. You know, when your own people are being lynched and you help the aggressor because you see beyond that, that's really something else, isn't it? So that, to be able to live virtuously like that, that's something to really recognize as who you are, what you do, how you act. And that, because it's in step with reality, because it recognizes our interconnectedness, it draws us closer to people, doesn't it? That inner professionalism doesn't separate us from others. Doesn't mean that we then unintentionally or intentionally harm them. We care for them. We have a responsibility for them. And the last one then of what, who we are really, what we can take pride in and really appreciate is our ability to overcome the afflictive emotions, to overcome delusion. So it's kind of courage. And in the Buddhist tradition, there's this whole kind of tradition of a bodhisattva warrior. So we go after the enemy, not the external enemy, not the enemy out there, but the internal enemy of self-righteousness, of pride, of ignorance, of craving, of hatred, all of those inner enemies, jealousy, resentment, the inner terrorists that are far worse than any external aggressor. So you have this courage of your convictions that no matter what, we can overcome those afflictive emotions, those distorted attitudes. No matter what, we can overcome them because we, the nature of our mind is clean and clear and pure. All of those afflictions are like distortions. They can be fixed, removed, deconstructed. So that one, the courage of our convictions. That's also, who am I really? I'm the courage of my convictions. Now I have a little reading from Kathleen MacDonald, which sums it up really nicely. So this is from this book, How to Meditate, fantastic book. It's in its like 25th anniversary printing. It's got really good meditations and explanations and background that are very good for the modern Western mind. So this is what she says, page 59, appreciating our human life. The starting point for many problems is the way we feel about ourselves and our human life. Human existence is very precious, but normally we fail to appreciate it. We have so much potential, so much latent wisdom and loving kindness, so much to offer the world, but we may ignore or be unaware of this and let ourselves become clouded with depression. Focusing on shortcomings in our character and failings in our dealings with people and work, for instance, or the harm that we might have done to others, we develop an unfair, low opinion of ourselves. This self-image becomes more and more concrete with time. We identify ourselves as incapable and inadequate, and then feel hopeless and depressed. Or we turn to other people in an attempt to find happiness and fulfillment, you know, appreciation and acknowledgement. However, as our friends are likely to feel the same way about themselves, such relationships often bring only more frustration. We can unlock the potential for happiness and satisfaction that lies within every one of us by becoming aware of our mental processes and then applying discriminating wisdom to all of our actions of body, speech, and mind. But to hope to be able to achieve this and through it fulfillment without first completing the necessary groundwork is to invite frustration. We must start by building a firm foundation based on a realistic view of ourselves. We have to accept our positive as well as our negative traits and determine to nourish the good and transform or eliminate the bad aspects of our character. Eventually, we'll recognize how fortunate we are to have been born human. And once we understand this, we can begin to train our minds to achieve enlightenment. So it's nice, isn't it? So when we ask, who am I really? The answer, well, it depends. And because it depends, then we can change. We can change what our aim is. Why put a limit on it? We can change how we feel to recognize everybody is the same as us in wanting to have a good life, wanting to feel safe, wanting to feel loved, wanting to be understood just like us. And that way, then when we walk into a room of people, instead of seeing all of the differences, we'll just naturally feel warm because they're my people. So like His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, you know, when he says, my brothers and sisters, he genuinely feels like that, doesn't he? My brothers and sisters. I'm like, oh, His Holiness thinks of me as his sister. How lucky am I? He genuinely does about each and every living being. And this is where it comes from recognizing what we base our identity on isn't all of those circumstantial differences that we hold on to like a sinking person, hoping they'll make us feel special and important. But it's recognizing this common humanity that we have. So that's the end of today's presentation. I forgot to prepare a poll. but really, the thing to take away from this is the four positive prides that we can have: a pride in our potential, a pride in, our potential, what we can achieve, a pride in our innate human intelligence, how we can act as a human being, a pride in our virtuous activities, and pride in our ability to overcome delusion. They're really the main things. So thank you so much, everybody, for coming along and sharing the morning.